Hello, welcome to the Long Shot Leaders podcast. I'm Michael Stein. My guest today is Ethan Gallogly. Ethan has been a leader in the Sierra Club, the Cal Hiking and Outdoor Society at UC Berkeley, and the Outdoors Club of Southern California. His boots have covered countless miles, including the John Muir Trail, the High Sierra Trail, and the Oregon section of the Pacific Crest Trail, and the Theodore Salomons Trail. He's a reviewer for the Wilderness Press Guides, Sierra North, Sierra South, and Yosemite National Park, and has read nearly every book on the history of the Sierra Nevada. Gallogly is a modern-day Thoreau, weaving together the majesty of nature and a philosophical sense of humanity. Sounds good to me. Here's a really interesting guy. Here is Ethan Gallogly. All right, I'm here with Ethan Gallogly, and interesting guy. You know, we love the outdoors, you know, and I love to, you know, hear about adversity. We're going to have hear about both those things. I want to go back into, you know, this man is, you know, he's lived in China for 5 years. He's traveled. I wanted to know where you're from, and were you always an outdoor person? Tell us a little about yourself.
Sure. Well, thank you for having me on the podcast, Michael. So I was born on the East Coast, actually in New York City. I grew up most of my life, well, now most of my life on the West Coast, but back then I grew up in Connecticut. And yeah, I'd say I was always into the outdoors. I wasn't as into hiking as I became in, you know, later life. My parents, when I was a kid, would take me places and I'd be like, do we have to walk so far? You know, and so I'd never imagine I'd become a long distance hiker. But, you know, I always loved camping and being outside. When I was 13, I took a bike trip through Vermont and New Hampshire for a month that was just amazing. You know, I love those things, but I really got into hiking when I moved out to California.
Where in Connecticut did you grow up? My wife's from Connecticut. She's from a small town in Tolland outside of Hartford. Where'd you grow up?
Tolland. Ah, very nice. I grew up actually in Westport. And then I went to school, my undergrad at the University of Connecticut, which is not far from Tolland.
Yeah, UConn.
Yep. The Huskies.
Did you? Yeah, that's right. Did you used to frequent the UConn Dairy Bar?
Not so much.
But it's the best ice cream you'll ever have in your whole life.
Yeah, no, but I had a great time at UConn. It's a wonderful school.
So, all right. So you come out to California, or where on the West Coast did you come?
Yeah. So for graduate school, I studied chemistry. I came out to the University of California, Davis. I'd actually had two offers I was considering. I'd been invited to go to Dartmouth and was planning to go there, but I figured on a whim, I'd go check out California. You know, they were flying me out and I just fell in love with it. I just was so blown away by the whole, you know, West Coast that I'm like, nope, I'm changing my plans. I'm moving out here. And I haven't regretted it. I've just loved California and the open country. That's, I don't know, it's an amazing place.
Back then, did you know what you wanted in life? Did you know what you wanted to do as far as a livelihood or what your mission was? Did you, what was your thoughts?
I changed majors in college about 8 times. No, I had no clue. And I went through so many different directions in life. I think life is a big exploration. You sort of follow your muse. If something new calls to you, you go that way. Writing was a big new thing to me. That started with actually a chemistry book. And then this novel that I wrote about the John Muir Trail was all sort of a random walk. I would never have expected to be doing this. But once I got into writing, I found it to be so, it's a very hard thing to explain, Michael, because it's a very personal thing. You spend a lot of time alone on the computer in your head, and it's really different from anything else you can do. And I think you have to be, like myself, pretty introspective to do it. But you also have to have a tale to tell, something to bring to the table. And it's, for me, it's wonderful. I will pass hours writing and not even know that the time has gone by. I remember once my wife popping in and saying, hey, do you want some lunch? And I'm like, I have 5 minutes. And you know, she comes back and she's like, dinner's ready. And I'm like, what? You know, but that's what happens when you're lost in it. And, you know, it's really, if that's your calling, it's a wonderful process. It's certainly not for everybody.
You know, this book that you wrote, you know, it's interesting because I talked to a accomplished filmmaker one time. He says, you know, it's a calm process, you're writing. And, you know, once you make your piece of art, it's yours. But then you put it out there in the world, that's not yours anymore. When you wrote this book, you know, it's like, well, that's my story. But people are like, hey, you know, now it's their story, yeah, so to speak. Did you experience that?
Yeah. I mean, I guess I still feel it's my baby. It's out there in the world growing up. It's like children. You know, you send them out, you hope you've given them the best education you can. And they still come home to do the laundry and celebrate the holidays, you know. And the book is like that. It's out there. It's growing. It's getting an audience. I've had some amazing reviews from people. Some people where, you know, they've written things that are very touching to me. Like it helped them overcome grief and other issues, which, you know, surprises me. But it's not why I wrote the book. But it's, you know, if it touches somebody in a different way, it's really heartwarming for me. And I guess, yeah, it's living its own life in that sense. Everybody has their interaction with it. But I see that feedback online. And I just, you know, it's like watching a child grow up. It's really, you've got a sense of accomplishment and, you know, pride as you're watching them grow. But you're right. I don't have much control over what happens with it after it's out in the world.
We want to get back to the book. Let's go back. Let's go to China. Let's go. Well, sure. How do we segue there?
Well, I finished graduate school in 93. And, you know, it had been after all the events of 1989. Those all happened when I was in school. And
1989?
The Tiananmen Square incident.
Ah.
So I had a lot of, you know, in graduate school, there are a lot of students from mainland China. And I had a lot of friends who were fairly, you know, I don't know how to describe it. It was a big moving thing for them. And, you know, I got kind of wrapped into that in a way with my friends. And I really learned a lot about Chinese culture from those interactions and became fascinated with it. I had also always had an interest in the Tao Te Ching, you know, the philosophical book. And I had read a few versions of it, but they were all different. And so I joked with my friends, half joking. I said, you know, I should learn Chinese. Then I can read this book in Chinese and I'll understand it directly, which really shows my naivety at the time, because it's like ancient poetry. It's older than Chaucer. I mean, it's not, it's like ancient English to us. It's harder to read than Shakespeare. So, you know, I thought, oh, I just take a class and I can translate this. No, it's not that simple. But I did take a class. You know, a friend said, oh, you'll never do this. So I enrolled in one. I was taking it early morning before I went to work. And I fell in love with the language. You know, it's a fascinating language. The ancient culture I find fascinating. I'm not much into the modern politics and all that, but I really like the philosophy, the poetry. Chinese poetry is amazing. And I brought some of this into the book. One of the two main characters, Sid, I made a professor of Asian philosophy. So he brings in some of these aspects of the poems and the philosophy that I really found, you know, in enticing about China. And when I finished graduate school, I'd taken a couple of years of language. I was almost fluent. And I decided, you know, I want to go spend a year over in China. So I, much against the advice of my advisor, I took a job teaching English over in China for a year and a half. And loved it. You know, it's like we said, everything in life takes you in a different direction. And that was transformational for me. It was really a great experience. And it also landed me a job at UC Berkeley when I came back, because they needed somebody to be a lecturer and work with their teaching assistants, the majority of which were from China at the time. And, you know, here I was, a chemist who spoke, you know, Chinese fluently by then. So I was a pretty good fit for that position. And then that kind of launched my teaching career in chemistry. So, you know, that it, you never know how life is going to work out. But I would always tell somebody, look, if you have an opportunity, you have something that opens up that seems interesting, follow it, right? Just grab it. Don't ignore it, because these chances don't come around that often. And when they do, that little door opens and you should walk through and see where it takes you.
Right. I have a friend that taught English in China, and I said, what were the cultural, you know, things that you could share? He said, you know, they really his class at least appreciated the respect for knowledge, for attaining more not just a consciousness level, but just knowledge in general. Did you notice any, what are some of the key points that you went in your teachings there that you came away with, the cultural differences or the uniquenesses of it?
So I was teaching from 93 to about 95, which is very different from modern China. I've been back a number of times, and it's like watching the Chinese go through our 1950s, 60s, 70s, and, you know, 2000s. It all compacted into a short time. So it was really interesting to see their changes. Back then, there was tremendous respect for education. There was tremendous respect for teachers. My students were always extremely polite, attentive, would do 110% of the assignments, no complaints. And it was wonderful as a teacher. It was the best classes of students I have ever had. You know, none of this sort of thing in America where students will be whining about, well, could I get another 2 points and get an A or whatever. It's really about, in those days, the learning. They cared about learning English and mastering the language, and they did a great job. I'm still in touch with a number of my students from back then. Really wonderful people. Now, over the years, it's shifted a little. China has gone from, you know, more of a traditional society to more of a, what we call modern. I'm not sure it's progress isn't always progress, but they've become much more materialistic, much more about the money. And there's a big sense in modern China about whether education is worth it, which, you know, we see here as well. The question of, you know, is business better than getting a degree and so forth? And I don't have a great answer for those things, but there's definitely been a shift in the culture there.
When you were in China, were you, you said you were always in the outdoors, because I want to segue into you kind of built a, somewhat of a, outside of teaching, a career identity for the outdoors. What was your experiences in China as far as the outdoors are concerned? And then help us segue back into where's that shift, you know, when you come back to the States?
Yeah. So again, I was there in the 90s. And if you go to China now, outdoors is a big thing. There are hikers, mountaineering clubs, you know, the Chinese have gone up Everest. There's all kinds of Chinese interest in the outdoors. In the 90s, it was very different. I remember one particular incident where I, you know, as I said, I love camping and hiking, and I was getting tired of being in the city. So I had my backpacking gear with me, and I went out to climb a little local mountain and just, you know, camp up there. And I decided to cowboy camp, no tent. So I climbed up the mountain in the evening. I threw out my sleeping bag and I went to bed, and it was beautiful. I was just wonderful. About 4 in the morning, I'm woken up to this noise and these flashlights in my face and all these Chinese people asking me, who are you? What are you doing here? And I'm like, who are you? You know, it's like, why are you up here on the mountain? And they, you know, I spoke Chinese, and they were all going up to the tea house on top to do Tai Chi, you know, traditional Chinese exercises. And they were shocked to find me there. They thought I was a robber or, you know, some outlaw hiding out on the mountains. They asked me, what are you doing there? And I'm like, well, I just wanted to get out of the city and relax. And they're like, but you have an apartment, don't you? You're a foreigner. You can afford to sleep in the city. And I'm like, yeah, but I want to be here. I want to be out in nature. And they're like, but why? You know, and they just couldn't get through their heads why someone would want to leave the comforts of the city for, you know, for this. And it was fascinating. And I finally explained it to them. And they took me up to the tea house and their friends gathered, because in those days it was rare to have a foreigner. And they were like showing off their foreigner that they had found. It was like they had discovered an alien in the forest. And, you know, they're like, he wanted to be here. He was sleeping on the mountain, you know. So that was China in the 90s. They really were not into the outdoors for the most part. But now, oh my God, every city has a hiking store. So, you know, now camping and all that has become a big thing. But it's recent. You know, there's been huge change there. And of course, you know, you asked me about my experiences. I've been backpacking since graduate school. You know, I would find graduate school is pretty intense, particularly in the sciences. And I would find going up to the mountains over the weekends, I would take most weekends off and just go hiking. My advisor would have preferred me to be in the lab, but I think I was much more productive for my time in the wilderness. I like to say that, you know, when you're out there, you really clear your head. You really have space to think, relax, and reflect. And it's just amazing. And I think it's a very important human experience that a lot of us are missing now, is this connection with nature. So I like to say that time out is really time in, that when you're out there in nature, you have the space and the time to, you know, recreate yourself. And it's interesting, that word recreation is really recreation. And I think as humans, we need that time and that space to sort of rejuvenate and recoup and just, you know, it inspires new directions. So I think it's very important to take time out in natural spaces. And I'd been doing that since graduate school. I've been drawn to the mountains.
What does your life look like when you get back to the States? What do you segue into that?
From China, you mean?
Yeah. Well, I hit the ground running.
I only had a little bit of money in my pocket. The Chinese economy wouldn't have paid for anything. I needed to get a job. I came back to Davis, where I'd done my graduate work, and I was able to pick up a part-time teaching position at the university, which got me enough money to pay for an apartment and all this. And then I started looking for full-time work. And within a year, as I said, I'd gotten that position at Berkeley and then became a full professor down in Los Angeles. So, you know, it's interesting. But again, there's always that scary moment of, you know, I've got no money. What am I going to do? But I find the universe provides. There's always a door. There's always something that opens. And if you step through it, it's good. You know, you take those opportunities.
Let's talk about the book. Tell us a little bit about the book.
So when I was 50, I did my first through hike of the John Muir Trail, which is a 211-mile trail from Yosemite to Mount Whitney. Most of it is above 8,000 feet. In fact, quite a bit of it is above 10. And you go over, I think it's 6-7 major passes, which for the most part are up around 12. Whitney itself is at 14. So it's a very high altitude, very arduous trek. And I'd always thought about doing it, and I'd done parts of it. But at 50, I just said, you know, I'm going to do this. And I took a month and I hiked the trail from end to end, which we call through hiking. And when I got back, I just couldn't get it out of my head. The experience of hiking the trail, the people you meet on trail, just being disconnected from the cell phone and you know, the modern world. You're really in the wilderness that whole time. I think you cross one road on the whole trip. So you're really disconnected. You're really immersed in nature. And that experience just wouldn't leave my head. I just felt the need, you know, to share it with somebody. And, you know, as a college professor, I'd set up a lecture and I was going to give a talk about the John Muir Trail. And I, you know, as a professor, I started researching the history and the background, and I learned all kinds of things that I hadn't known about, you know, John Muir and the explorers and the history. And I was really excited to give this talk, and it got preempted. So I'm sitting there with all this information. I'm just thinking, how do I get this out? And it just hit me. I can write a book. I can write a, you know, a book about the Muir Trail. And I thought about writing a history, but there's probably 20 people on the planet who'd buy a history of the Muir Trail. So I decided a novel would be the best way. Something that would interest everyone, would be exciting, would have a real, you know, a gripping story, but would weave in these facts and history about the trail. And so that's how my book was born.
Now, you haven't written any fictional, you know, before, have you?
I had never written fiction before. And, you know, I did have a book that I co-authored on chemistry, a nonfiction book, and that's a huge thing. But I guess working on that book on chemistry made me confident that I could do fiction. I naively thought fiction is going to be easier, right? Because you just make it up. You don't have to check all the story facts or something. I mean, everything about the Muir Trail in that book is not made up. Everything I wrote about the trail and its history is absolutely researched. But what I found was, no, writing fiction is much harder. Writing characters and dialogue and all this is really difficult. And it's funny because I wrote the first draft of the book over the course of about a year. And I thought, oh, this is great. Wonderful book. You know, it has all the history. Everything's woven in. I thought, this is it. It's going to be a terrific hit. I gave it to, I guess, about 8 of my trusted friends who are good readers and who I know will give me honest feedback. And that's important because a lot of people will not. But I trusted them to give me feedback. And to a person, they told me it was awful. You know, it was
those are good friends.
It read like a travel log, like a Lonely Planet guide to the Muir Trail, except it wasn't that interesting. You know, the story didn't captivate them. The dialogue was just, I mean, if I go back and read that first edition now, it was terrible, the first draft. But you learn, and it went through, I think, 9 different drafts, and it took another 3-4 years before I had that book tuned up to the point where people were praising it and saying, wow, this is great, you know. But it's a process, and I learned, but I loved the process. That's the thing. I mean, I loved the process of writing that book and everything I learned along the way. So even though it sounds awful, right, to spend another 3-4 years doing rewrites, I'm a better writer for it. And the process was wonderful. So, that's what I mean about books. You have to really be into this. You have to be open to criticism, and you have to have a passion for writing. And I think for many people, this idea that you sit at a machine and you type out a book in 2 days is, you know, it's a Hollywood thing. I mean, there's probably maybe Stephen King can do it, but, you know, there are very few people who can type out a book and have it be almost publication ready. I think for most people, it's a much bigger task than they imagine. But if you're into this, if you like that self-perfection and self-discipline and sort of the escape it provides, you know, I liken it to learning martial arts. You know, you practice every day, you increase incrementally, really, really tiny increases, but it's the process and the growth of doing it that draws you into it. And if you've got that personality, it's for you.
Right. And most things can be applied to that because, you know, writing is rewriting and improving it, you know, every like 3% at a time is can go with any skill set. Where are you at today? What's going on with you right now?
I'm at home, although the background here is off
your life. So theoretically, your life right now, your career and your life.
So I'm in transition again. I'm retiring from teaching. This is my last year of teaching. And I have moved back to Northern California. I was living down in Los Angeles for the last 20-something years. And I've been dreaming about getting back to Northern California. So this year I've moved back up north, closer to the Sierra, closer to, I just like the vibe in Northern California. And I am currently packing. And when I say packing, it's going to be about a 3-4 month process for the Pacific Crest Trail, the PCT, which is a huge undertaking. Now that I'm retiring, I've got the time to do it. My wife has given her stamp of approval. And that's about a 5-month hike from the Mexican border to Canada, about 2,650 miles over the Sierra and over the Cascade Range. So it's all over the rooftop of the tallest mountains along the way. It's comparable to the Appalachian Trail on the East Coast. It's goes through all kinds of different weather regimes, from the desert, you know, you're going through the Mojave Desert, to the High Sierra, to the rainforests of Washington. It's pretty daunting. And so I'm doing everything from trying to get the weight of my backpack down, which is a big issue, to figuring out how I'm going to get the food for, you know, for this adventure. So that's going to be my next 3 months is packing and preparing for the PCT. But I'm thrilled to be doing it.
That's insane. I mean, I've done that drive from from Vancouver down to Mexico. Yep. And the drive is a bitch, let alone walking on the mountain crest, you know, for 5 months. Now that's insane.
Well, it sounds insane, but for me, it's a dream. It's the idea of being out in nature and just walking, and how that transforms your life and your thinking, the people you meet. There's a sort of community on trail between all the people out there, and it just becomes kind of a moving group of folks who are like-minded. And it's really, really, it's really spiritual. It's like being on a spiritual journey. It is how I would liken it. I can't think of other ways to describe it. Not for everyone, for sure. But it's, for me, it's been calling to me for years. And this is the first time I'll have enough time being retired to do something like this. I think most of the hikers on trails like this are either in their 20s, they quit their job, or they're fresh out of college, or they're new retirees. So, you know, I mean, there are a few random people who are just like, you know what, I'm going to go for this, but it's a big undertaking.
Yeah, aside from the pleasure part of it, you know, there's been studies, and I'm paraphrasing now, on that, you know, taking a time off to being in nature and just totally, you know, like disconnecting, you know, your consciousness level gets raised, and also it resets you to, you know, and a lot of people find they do, you know, it's like intermittent fasting, they'll do micro sessions of this, and it helps their performance. And when they, you know, let's say they want to go back to the workplace or whatever, you know, it helps them to get reset and perform better.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And I, you know, something like the PCT, I think, is extreme. But for most people, I would say, yes, getting some time out in nature, taking a weekend and just camping, even car camping, although I think backpacking is better because you get the physical exertion in, you're doing something where it's repetitive, so your mind can kind of get let loose a little bit more. And where you camp, maybe nobody's there. You know, I like to say backpacking is like staying in a 10,000 star hotel, right? You're looking up at those stars and there's no one there. And, you know, you've just got these amazing surroundings. It's wonderful. Have you done some camping, hiking, or backpacking, Michael?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I own a tarp and canopy company for two decades. And I just, a couple years back, I went to West Texas out in Trualingua, middle of the desert.
Wow.
And something that, you know, where I had friends that lived out there, and I would never go out there. It's like, you know, like it's a near the, you know, about an hour north of the border of Mexico. And we're talking in the middle of nowhere, and just get off the highway in the middle of nowhere. And I swear, you know, we spent a couple of days there, but I actually came up with one of the best ideas for a company, you know? So what I say, it kind of reset me, put me in an environment I wouldn't be in, no cell phone because it doesn't work, you know, in the middle of nowhere, and came back and discovered a whole new, you know, company that I'm forming that's an outdoor related product outside of the tarps and canopies and a whole new vision. And yeah, so that was a, you know, camping as a kid, you know, but it wasn't a major thing. But that going out there just for just even a couple of days, you know, let alone you're talking 5 months for you, but you know, on that last thing, but it's quite something special. And as a matter of fact, for a little levity, you know, it's 4 o'clock in the morning, it's freezing, it's in February. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, you ever had that dream where you have to go to the bathroom and you think, you know, and I'm like, oh, I haven't gone to the bathroom yet. I was dreaming that. So I finally get up and go to the bathroom. Everybody's talking about, you know, shooting stars, you know, oh, you're going to see a meteor shot. He goes out there. You could see that because you're away from the city, so far away. And I was like, oh, I haven't seen anything yet. So I'm sitting there and I finally get to go to the bathroom and I look up and I'm like, first of all, I'm having the most pleasurable experience because I'm alleviating myself. And then I see a shooting star and I was like, ah, two feelings at the same time of that, you know, and that was my, that and taking a crap in the middle of the desert, you know, there's nowhere to go in the middle of the desert. So, you know, there's no trees, there's no bushes, there's like just, I mean, barely any green. And that, being out there, by in nothing gave me an idea for something. So yeah, it was a magical experience. And I have gone, that was the best camping trip I've ever been on.
That's fantastic. I know exactly what you're talking about. In fact, it's funny you mentioned that thing about going to the bathroom and seeing the shooting star, because at the end of the second chapter in my book, Gil, the protagonist, he's not very likable. He doesn't want to be camping. He's overweight. He just doesn't want to be there. And he's had a miserable day. You know, he's had to walk with the pack. It doesn't fit. The tent's all difficult to set up. He rips his sleeping bag. I mean, he's just had a miserable day. And he has to pee. And he goes out at night. And exactly like you described, he steps out. He relieves himself. And he looks up. And there are those stars. And there's, you know, a shooting star. And it's just such a mystical, magical experience to see that, you know, that's the first touch of transformation of the character in the book, is that moment out at night peeing, you know, and it's funny because it's so common. A lot of people I know, you know, have that experience of opening the tent at night and just, wow, you know, it's so different. You see the Milky Way and everything else. I totally know where you're coming from there.
Yeah. And there's two types of experiences. I'm sure you'd be the more authority to talk about this, but the two types of experiences that you can have when you're camping is one is you're by yourself. And that's a profound experience. But then if you go with a group of people, the bonding that you do with that group of people, I mean, for matter, just traveling with any group of people, you know, if they're good friends and you want to really expand the friendship, you know, but camping, the simplicity of it and being away from certain, you know, vices and things and spending time with those people really opens up your relationships with them. And if you're by yourself, it opens up the relationship with yourself.
Yeah, I totally agree on both points. I think when you're with people in the woods, even people you've just met, there's an openness that doesn't exist in the city. You know, in the city, you walk up to someone, you're like, even a colleague you've worked with your whole life, how are you? Oh, I'm fine. Good to see you. But there's no depth. There's no conversation there. And in the workplace, we're very guarded, right? If you're going through something painful, unless the person is really, really close and you trust them, you almost don't want to share that because you're worried about how it might affect your career. So there's a guardedness that I think a lot of us experience in the office, but in nature, we drop our guard. We meet people as human beings face to face. We support each other. There's something really, really bonding and connecting with people. And then, as you said, if you go on your own, and I've done a lot of hikes on my own, sometimes for up to a month, and it's quite different. You spend a lot of time in your head. It's not for everyone. I think for a lot of people, that can be an issue. I think a lot of people don't have, I don't know how to say it, but for a lot of people, that complete disconnect is a little too much. But if you're open to it and you're comfortable, that becomes like a vision quest. That becomes really, really an inner trip into who you are. And the only thing you have are your thoughts, right? So it becomes extremely introspective. And like you said, you came out of just a weekend with a new business idea. Right. For me, that trip on the Muir Trail, I came out with a book. Not that I was going in looking to have a book. Who knows what 5 months on the PCT will bring? It's really, really amazing. And I just can't say enough how important time out in nature is.
Right. Long term, big picture, standing back after you take the trek, you go, you do this. You plan that far ahead? What do you have planned for yourself? What is your life going to look like? What's going on?
It'll be completely different from whatever I say. You know, like I can tell you that right now. I do not know. I love hiking, so I'll probably go over to Europe and do some of these treks there, some hut-to-hut treks. I'm getting a little tired at my age of carrying all the food and the tents. So I like the idea of going hut-to-hut where they give you a bed and some food. But I don't know. I may end up writing another book. I have a couple of ideas in my head. I may end up in a completely different direction, like you're describing. So it's open. I'll be retiring. Anything goes.
Well, this is a nice bookend then, because this fits really nicely into your background in Asia, because that's a very Zen Taoist philosophy that you have. So I like it. I think it's wonderful. I love your story. And please tell everybody how they can find out more about you.
Well, sure. The book I wrote about the John Muir Trail, which has a lot of the philosophy and other things we've been talking about, you can get online. The Trail, very simple, by Ethan Gellogley. It's on Amazon. It's on Audible, if you like Audible books. In fact, we had an amazing narrator for it. I almost like the audiobook more than the written book now. But it's available on all the major platforms, bookshop.org, Amazon, whatever. I don't know what else to say. I have a website, you know, I'm up on Facebook and all that stuff. But
Ethan Gallowgly, thank you for sharing today. Really love it. Nice story.
Thank you for having me, Michael. I really appreciate it.
That was author and outdoor Thoreau extraordinaire, Ethan Gallowgly. And this quote's named by the man that the trail's named after, that Ethan has trekked. Between every two pines, there is a doorway to a new world. John Muir. Thank you for joining us. And I look forward to hanging out with you all on the next episode. All right. Have you guys been to longshotleaders.com? That's where you can check out all of the guests and the bios and the backgrounds and more. Also, if you haven't done so already, subscribe to the podcast on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what we do, give us a good rating. Tell your family and friends to come by and listen. It's going to make you feel nice and toasty inside. Every week we'll be delivering knowledge, creativity, inspiration, exasperation, perspiration. If it ends with a shun, basically you're going to find it here. All right, thank you for joining us. And in the great words of Bill Murray in the movie Caddyshack, friends for life, I say.